As the threat of global warming grows increasingly more urgent, some scientists are looking at ways to alter the climate through something called geoengineering. On today's underreported segment, we'll take a look at what geoengineering is, whether it could reverse climate change, and what side effects it would produce if some of the proposed projects were ever implemented. Joining me now is Graham Wood, a staff editor at The Atlantic, who's written about geoengineering for the July-August issue of the magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
More governments are working on slowing down climate change by cutting carbon emissions. How are most geoengineering proposals different?
Geoengineering proposals tend to be much cheaper, first of all, and that introduces all sorts of problems. But what we're looking at are interventions in the climate that would usually cost somewhere on the order of $10 to $100 billion per year to implement. And you're comparing that with some costs of perhaps $1 trillion a year to just cut emissions.
Most of the engineers think that the sun, not CO2, is the enemy in the battle against climate change.
That's right. Some of the best and best developed proposals so far have involved just finding ways so that the sun does not reach the Earth. And that can include constructing enormous shades in space that are halfway between the sun and the Earth. Or they can include just trying to fog up the atmosphere with sulfur dioxide in ways that will sort of baffle the sun's rays and make them bounce more harmlessly into space.
But we need the sun. Don't we get vitamin D from the sun?
There's many nice things about the sun, that's true. And we wouldn't actually be reducing the amount of sun that hits the Earth so much that it would destroy crops. It would be actually imperceptible in most of the plans that have been suggested by geoengineers to us as just normal people on the Earth's surface. But it would be very cheap to reduce the amount of sunlight just enough to counteract pretty much all of the global warming that's happened as a result of gas emissions.
Are most of the geoengineering ideas on the table doable with today's technology?
There's a few of them that we are almost certain would work. And the one that I mentioned previously about sulfur dioxide emission, which would include sending up perhaps fleets of zeppelins that have tubes that emit sulfur dioxide in huge quantities, these are ideas that we are almost certain would work and that really just require some engineering solutions to make them cheap enough to do or even cheaper to do. But once they're done, we are almost certain that we could reduce global warming back to what it was in pre-industrial times, probably in just a matter of a couple years.
Isn't sulfur dioxide the main chemical compound in acid rain?
It is, and that is one concern about that solution. But, you know, we already do pump out a lot of gases that create acid rain, and the amount that would be added by having these zeppelins or in some other kinds of scenarios, fleets of airplanes that would pump out sulfur dioxide. The amount that would be added by that would not really be enough to cause enough acid rain for us to have to worry that much about it.
But they'd have to keep on pumping them indefinitely, wouldn't they?
That is one of the really troubling things about geoengineering solutions like this. If you do stop pumping out sulfur dioxide, then it does rain out. It becomes acid rain, and then suddenly the sun is hitting us just as much as it always was. And all of that carbon that we'd been emitting with cars, etc., in the meantime, would still be there. It wouldn't do anything to remove the carbon from the atmosphere. And as a result, if, say, we pumped out sulfur dioxide and cooled the atmosphere for 20 years and then we stopped, then in just a couple years, all of that built-up carbon would hit us, and the Earth would warm back to what it would have been if we had done no sulfur dioxide emission at all for the previous 20 years. So instead of getting a slow dialing up of the thermostat, it would hit us really quick, and it would be extremely painful in that circumstance.
Well, you compare the gas, the atmosphere with sulfur dioxide strategy to the movie Blade Runner.
Yeah, there is, as I said, not too much that you would notice about the atmosphere on a day-to-day basis. If you were just to look up at the sky, it would still be a blue sky. But one thing that does happen with the sulfur dioxide gas is that it would become particles, and during the sunset, it might make the skies a dark red. It would cause really picturesque sunsets to happen. And it might look a bit like what it looks like in Blade Runner.
Well, you say that geoengineering has been widely viewed by most mainstream scientists as crankish for decades. Are these ideas becoming more mainstream now?
They're becoming a bit more mainstream, partially just because we're talking a lot more about climate change. Now, there are some ideas that really do have the sound of mad science. There's one that includes shooting ceramic frisbees into space at a staggering rate. We're talking millions and millions and millions for
and what would that
a decade
do?
At a time. And what that would do would the frisbees would hang at the gravitational midpoint between the Earth and the Sun, and then we would basically just have a whole bunch of shades in space that would cause the amount of sunlight that hits us to be that much less. Now, this, as I say, would involve creating a kind of gun that doesn't exist yet that's over a mile long. We'd have to build 20 of those, and we would put them at high-altitude locations. So, but when I say high-altitude, I mean like at the top of the Alps. And we would be firing these frisbees out madly for 20 years, 10 to 20 years. And this sounds like mad science because it is. And I should say that the scientist who suggests it, Roger Angel, he who's a professor at the University of Arizona, even he doesn't think it's a great idea to do it. But what many of these solutions show is that the options that are available to us are a bit more diverse than the usual array of carbon emissions ideas that are floated.
Two of the ideas involve seawater, don't they? One involves using ships to churn up seawater, and another one says that we should fertilize the oceans with iron. Why those?
Well, one nice thing about those is that they can be done on the ocean, which, of course, is most of the surface of the Earth. The one that you refer to about seawater, the first one, is an idea that was developed by John Latham, who's at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And that involves taking 1,500 ships and then adding enormous propellers to them that are pointed straight up, so they churn up seawater, they spray it into the air, and the clouds that are hit by the spray of the seawater get whiter, get fluffier, and reflect more of the sun's rays back into space. And this is an idea that has been around for a little while, but it's been developed in really minute detail especially by an engineer named Stephen Salter, and we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to implement. And
spraying the sea mist indefinitely.
We would have to keep on doing it. If by spraying sea mist into the air, we don't do anything about getting rid of the carbon that's actually in the atmosphere and that does enormous damage through things like ocean acidification. So you'd have to keep having this armada of ships going around constantly, spraying upward, making those fluffy clouds, and cooling down the Earth.
But the other sea idea would involve getting some CO2 from the atmosphere, and there are a number of different approaches to getting rid of carbon. How would fertilizing the oceans with iron work? And then maybe you could tell us a bit about the carbon scrubbing towers and also the carbon eating trees.
Yes, as you say, this is a really big advantage. To be able to get rid of carbon is what the geoengineers really want to do. Now, there is a company called Climos in San Francisco that's working on the idea of fertilizing the ocean with iron. And what they're doing there is working with the observation that plankton blooms can happen only if there's a sufficient amount of iron in the water. So they have observed that if you take iron salts, throw them in the water, you'll get these enormous plankton blooms, which will suck in carbon from the atmosphere, and if all goes well, sink to the bottom of the sea, and they'll stay there for a long time.
And would that actually work?
Well, there are tests that have been done, and it depends who you ask whether the tests show that this idea has a lot of promise or just some. Right now, I don't think that enough has been done to say with certainty, but it's certainly one of the ideas that is more promising.
Well, one of the ones that appeals to me is genetic engineering trees to gobble up carbon. After all, we'd get more trees as a result, and everybody wants more trees.
Yes, that's right. There are some ideas. The physicist Freeman Dyson at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton has suggested that we find species of trees and engineer them in ways that will allow them to take more carbon out of the atmosphere and have that carbon in the trees decay into topsoil. And he's pointed out that all we really have to do is get one extra tenth of an inch of topsoil to decay over the land, over vegetation supporting land every year, and it would offset all carbon emissions. It would just be carbon that exists in a thin film all over the earth.
Now, what about the carbon scrubbing towers? Does that technology work?
That technology is in process, I would say. There are several teams that are working on creating towers that would look like industrial cooling towers in some of the plans, and they would have chemicals that would coat the inside of them that would simply bind to carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide would stick to this chemical, and it's just a matter of finding a way to clean the chemical out and put it back in the tower to take out more carbon dioxide afterward.
We'd have to find ways to store the carbon dioxide.
You do have to put it somewhere, that's right. And there are a lot of ideas of where that might be. Now, the idea that I mentioned earlier about plankton blooms has the elegant solution where they simply decay and they fall as what they call marine snow to the bottom of the seafloor. And they would stay there for a long time because there would be thousands and thousands of feet of water on top. Now, there are other ideas such as going to where the carbon originated in the first place, in some of the shale structures that used to bear petroleum, and just pump carbon into that. And we have these natural reservoirs where it could stay for thousands and thousands of years.
Now, they all sound kind of outlandish, and yet Nobel Prize-winning scientists are embracing some of them. So should we assume that some of this is actually going to be implemented?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's going to be implemented. There are certainly very reputable scientists who believe that we should explore. Now, I would say that all of the most reputable of those scientists think that cutting emissions is the way to go.
Well, I have
but they say...
Thank you. We unfortunately have run out of time. Graham Wood's article in The Atlantic is on geoengineering. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
On tomorrow's show, horticulturist Gerard Lordahl answers your gardening questions. Then the story behind the making of The Wizard of Oz. Also, we'll speak with the director, choreographer, and two of the dancers from the new dance production called Burn the Floor. Plus, our latest Please Explain is all about spices. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen and Miranda Schaefer. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.